Now is the winter of our discontent.
So says King Richard III, Shakespeare's most infamous villain. But is he really guilty of the venal crimes history has saddled him with? Today on With Good Reason, we take a look at two great frame-ups in history. Hello, I'm Carolyn Elliott. Some figures in history seem condemned to be eternally suspended in a sort of limbo between guilt and innocence. Consider the case of Dr. Samuel Mudd, whose family continues to demand that he be exonerated in the conspiracy plot to kill Abraham Lincoln. We'll talk about Dr. Mudd later in the program. But first, we focus on a 500-year-old mystery. Shakespeare portrayed him as the epitome of evil, a disfigured, power-hungry royal who plotted against his brother and killed his nephews to solidify his position as King of England. King Richard III was slain in battle by his cousin, Henry VII, who replaced him on the throne. But some say Richard died twice at Henry's hands, once on the battlefield and again in the history books. There is evidence that Richard's hands may be clean and that it was Henry VII who killed those boys and then encouraged Thomas More to write an historical account blaming Richard. With me to unravel this mystery is Catherine Moss, co-editor of the Norton Shakespeare and professor of English at the University of Virginia, and Dorothy Boyd Rush, historian and dean of the graduate school at James Madison University. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
And we'll hear more readings from Walter Kopich, professor of English at Virginia Commonwealth University. Dorothy Boyd Rush, there's a great contemporary movement to exonerate Richard of the crimes that Thomas More and William Shakespeare have accused him of. There's a webpage dedicated to this effort. Why this interest in this long-dead English ruler?
Perhaps because it's not cut and dry, and the whole world loves a mystery. And it seems like with Richard III, you have more mysteries than anything else. He's been charged with every crime that you can't really pin on somebody else for that era. I think it's also true that he outlived many members of his family, so he gets the blame for everything.
How important was this Shakespeare play to what ended up being written in history books, high school history books, college history books?
For many years, I think the school of thought was, the only thing I need to read to know English history is William Shakespeare. And also we have Thomas More involved in this as well, as you alluded to. And I don't know that we'd call him great history, but maybe one of the practitioners of hearsay history.
I think that that Shakespeare takes these texts, which as far as he knows are reliable, and runs with them. Part of what we love about Richard, which is not just that he's a villain, but that he's so theatrical and so gleeful about it. And he's always giving these sly soliloquies to the audience to let them know what the real story is. And he just has so much fun slashing his way to power. That's part of why he's such a compelling character. And actually, it's quite clear from Shakespeare's play that although Richard is a monster, there's no one who's innocent. Right, I mean, there's no good characters except for these poor little princes, and that's just because they're too young to have committed any villainy. So that this is a play in which Richard is portrayed as something that the English people kind of had coming to them. The institutions in this state have fallen apart. There's no sense of legitimacy anymore, and Richard takes advantage of that. But he could not exist had there not been a whole series of crimes committed by the other characters in this play, like Clarence, like Edward, like Lady Anne, like almost everybody else in the play. So they all have blood on their hands. Richard has more than the others, but they're all a mess.
But there are those, and we're going to get to this in a moment, who say that he really has no blood on his hands at all. He killed no one. He did not kill his nephews. There's a question as to his appearance, whether it was grotesque at all or whether he was actually a handsome man, a kind man, one who was dedicated to his brothers and families. The argument goes that Shakespeare almost portrayed him as the opposite of what he was. And I want to talk about that in a moment. But first, let's hear probably one of the most famous passages from Richard III, which talks about his appearance and also about his plotting against his brother and his plotting against his nephews.
I that am curtailed of this fair proportion, cheated of feature by dissembling nature, deformed, unfinished, sent before my time into this breathing world scarce half made up, and that so lamely and unfashionable that dogs bark at me as I halt by them. Why, I in this weak piping time of peace have no delight to pass away the time. unless to see my shadow in the sun, and to scant on mine own deformity. And therefore, since I cannot prove a lover to entertain these fair, well-spoken days, I am determined to prove a villain, and hate the idle pleasures of these days. Plots have I laid, inductions dangerous, by drunken prophecies, libels, and dreams, to set my brother Clarence and the king in deadly hate the one against the other. And if King Edward be as true and just as I am subtle, false, and treacherous, this day should Clarence closely be mewed up about a prophecy which says that G, of Edward's heirs, the murderer shall be. Dive thoughts down to my soul. Here Clarence comes.
Let's talk about his appearance first. Is there any evidence, either one of you, to indicate this man was so ugly that dogs would begin barking when he approached?
Contemporary depictions of him prove the contrary. He's perfectly normal in appearance. And we even have suits of armor that he is supposedly the wearer of. And there's a little bit of a bump on the back, but that would have been normal for one that was in the saddle and so highly skilled with the sword. So there is no contemporary evidence to suggest that he was deformed and depraved.
So the hunch of the hunchback that he's so famous for might just be muscle from using, let's say, that right arm?
Exactly.
Okay. Do you agree?
Yes, I think there's no evidence that Richard was deformed. Shakespeare was using the best sources he had, which were Thomas More and Raphael Holinshed, but they were partisan to the Tudors. They had a reason to insist that Edward was this monster, both physically and mentally a monster.
Well, Catherine Moss, give us a sense as to what Shakespeare did to help Henry and help the Tudors kind of justify their throne. He helped them out a great deal, obviously. It was to his advantage. Elizabeth was queen at the time. But he does quite a bit to bolster the Tudors, doesn't he?
Well, you have to realize that the idea that you would come invade a country and take away a crown from a reigning king is about as serious a crime as you can imagine in Renaissance England. It was high treason. It was very, very serious.
Which is what Henry VII does.
Yes. The only way that Shakespeare and these other historians can legitimate Henry's action is by making Richard seem like such a tyrant that someone has to get rid of him. There was a lot of writing in 16th century England, France, Spain, about the conditions under which it was legitimate for subjects to rise up and kill their king. Some people said, under no circumstances is it acceptable. Other people said, if the king was bad enough, you could get rid of him. I think that a lot of that thinking lies behind Shakespeare's Richard III and also More's and Holinshed's portrayals as well. By demonizing Richard, they justify Henry VII's action.
Let's go to the more serious charges that are in history and also definitely in the play by William Shakespeare. Let's talk about the fact that this man has, down for 500 years, been accused of killing his two nephews as part of his ambition to retain the throne. What people who are trying to set the record straight say, not only did Richard III not kill his nephews, but that it was actually Henry VII who was the slayer of Richard III in battle and who didn't have much right to the English throne and got it after Richard was killed, that killed those boys.
There's just as much proof that Henry did it as Richard did it. And
which is none.
That right. Is exactly right. So yes, Henry may have killed the princes. They were as much of a problem for him as they would have been a problem for Richard III.
Yeah, Catherine Moss?
It's also true that infant mortality was very high in this period. So these kids could have died, especially if they were in the Tower mm-hmm. of London. They could have just died from getting the flu or getting the plague without being murdered by anyone.
That's very true. Maybe Richard didn't do it, maybe Henry didn't, and the bacteria did them in.
Well, what's the evidence for on either side? What's the evidence that perhaps Richard did do it, did kill those two boys?
Richard might have killed the princes. I don't think it's a settled question. But if they survived his reign, Henry would have done away with them too.
Absolutely.
Because they were absolutely, they were just bars in the way of power, and they had no independent power base themselves.
And is there any evidence to indicate that Henry VII killed those boys?
He too had a motive, and he had a great deal at stake, the throne of England. And probably, knowing Henry's character as well as historians think they do, he wouldn't have been adverse to killing them if they stood in his way.
But Shakespeare portrays Henry as a very kind, benevolent, truly wonderful person, the antithesis to Richard's cruel, malicious character, correct, Catherine Moss?
That's one of the great moments in the Olivier movie is, you know, Olivier's been stumping around looking deformed for the whole movie, and then this incredibly handsome blonde bombshell is shown standing on a hill, and it's supposed to be a funny moment. You know, he's the Avenger who's going to bring virtue back into England. Shakespeare almost plays up the hokiness of that.
And if you take a look at some of the paintings done of Henry VII, you know he was never every woman's dream.
Not a handsome man.
No. Not actually, deformed, but not a handsome man.
Actually, what's striking, if you look at portraits of the two men side by side, is the strong family resemblance. They were cousins, and they look pretty much, you know, from the same general genetic pool.
Well, what does this mean as an historian, Dorothy Boyd Rush? If the historical record has indeed been wrong for these 500 years, if Richard was a handsome, healthy, kind man, did not kill his nephews, did not do all these terrible things, and he was indeed framed by the Tudors to kind of justify Henry VII's ascendancy to the throne, what does it mean historically? Is it a record that needs to be changed, or is this just a fun thing to talk about?
I think historians always like to seek the truth, and 20th century historians like to prove the case. They rely very heavily on documentary evidence. So we're just curious people. So we want to set the record straight. But in terms of revolutionizing our concept of British history of the period, it's really not going to do that. This was a violent age filled with violent men and women, and Richard was one of them. So his hands are not exactly without blood.
But give us a sense as to which way history is leaning on this issue, or is it just...
That he is maligned, but I doubt that we will say he is much maligned.
Catherine Moss?
That's right. If you read the... Shakespeare wrote three plays about the reign of Henry VI, the previous reign, and it's very clear, as I was saying, that the whole royal extended family has blood on their hands. Richard among them. He may not have been any worse, but to say that he's this kind, gentle, handsome man, those people got eliminated very quickly in this period. So he was a survivor, and he probably did what it took to survive.
And
that's
perhaps why he is charged with so much. He's the last survivor, so we can blame him for everything.
The last survivor of the Yorks.
Yes. Which is a great benefit to Henry VII. He is eliminated not to rise up in rebellion at a later date.
Well, let's talk about the Tudors here briefly, and Henry VII, who comes from a family that seems to have the kind of personality to do the things that Richard III is blamed for. He does not particularly have a right to the throne, does he, when he takes it?
Henry had England by right of conquest in the final analysis, and he very seldom, after the Battle of Bosworth Field in 1485, talked about his legitimacy. It was his England, as I said, by right of conquest. His position in history, though, is growing, increasing in stature. Today, we tend to talk about the two greatest members of the Tudor dynasty being Henry VII and his granddaughter Elizabeth. They're starting to overshadow by far the very flamboyant Henry VIII, the much married Henry VIII that we all think we know so much about.
Catherine Moss, one thing I wanted to talk about that you had mentioned to me earlier was that Richard III was the last of the plays of kind of the early era of Shakespeare. Was this the best of his early plays, do you think, Richard III?
Well, I don't know. He had written a number of comedies. He had written a couple of tragedies. He was certainly beginning to establish himself on the English stage as a major playwright. What happened shortly after Richard III is that there's a serious plague in London, and the theaters are closed for several years. Shakespeare obviously can't make a living as a playwright during that period, so he starts to write non-dramatic poetry, the poems Venus and Adonis, The Rape of Lucrece, comes back to the stage two years later when the theaters reopen, and begins to write, I think, on a different level. So shortly after the theaters reopen, he writes plays like Midsummer Night's Dream, Romeo and Juliet, which seem to me considerably less sort of crudely melodramatic than these early plays. But the early plays are very strong plays. But the best thing, I think Richard III is by far the best tragedy that's been written at that point. It's certainly the most subtle characterization of a tragic hero.
Is there a murderer here? No. Yes, I am. Then fly. What? For myself? Great reason why, lest I revenge. What? Myself upon myself? Alack, I love myself. Wherefore? For any good that I myself have done unto myself? Oh, no. Alas, I rather hate myself for hateful deeds committed by myself. I am a villain. Yet I lie. I'm not.
A scene from Richard III, read by Walter Coppedge of Virginia Commonwealth University. My guests today have been Catherine Moss, English professor from the University of Virginia, and Dorothy Boyd Rush, dean of the Graduate School at James Madison University. I'm Carolyn Elliott. You're listening to With Good Reason.